Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
My name is Alias. I speak Hazaragi, Urdu, Dari, Farsi, Hindi, and English. I am inspired by the kindness of people. My son's cuddle make me happy. So does watching him grow up and seeing my wife and family doing well. I love to watch Game of Thrones, The Walking Dead, and Homeland. I hope for a world where we control the system and the system does not control us.
This is In My Country, stories of people who came to Australia as refugees or asylum seekers and the many places we call home.
Hosted by Adam Wood and me, Pia Perversi-Birchall. This podcast was produced on Turrbal and Yuggera country. We pay our respects to traditional owners, past, present and emerging.
In this episode, Pia meets Alias Takawi, who was born in Afghanistan. Alias arrived in Australia in 2010 by boat. Today's story is about Alias's experiences with identity, religion, and luck. What brought him to his decision to board a boat to Australia? How did it all unfold? And what has he learnt from it all?
We're sitting here having this interview over at Cooper's, and Alias has just told me that you had your first drink after arriving in Australia, and it was at Cooper's.
That's right. I went to the pub with a friend in the beginning when I just came out of the detention centre in Adelaide. And I asked him, let's go and have a drink somewhere. And we went to the pub and I asked him which beer he likes the most. And he said Cooper's. So we tried Cooper's. In my country, where I lived most of my life, in Afghanistan and Pakistan, people seeking asylum and refugees are not considered to be political issues.
Alias was born in Afghanistan in the early 1990s in a mountainous area in the central eastern part of the country.
In Ghazal? Is that how I pronounce it?
Ghazni.
Sorry, Ghazni.
That's right, yeah.
He spent the first 6 years of his life on farming land that had been owned by his family for many generations. He lived with his parents and his two younger brothers in a big two-story house in a joint family system together with three generations of his family.
Almost 50 people.
50?
Almost. Yeah, 48, 50 people.
Alias says resources were scarce, but they had support from family and felt a strong connection to the land.
We were close to nature. We had our own spring where the water flows. We had our own, the mountain of the village that we could go on and have solitude. We could touch the water, the fresh water coming out of the mountain. We could feel the snow that fall down. We could see the wildlife close to us. I remember one night my father used to hunt. He was mainly hunting the wolves because they were dangerous. I remember it was a moonlight and on the snow, it was quite bright and it was winter. And I just woke up. My father was waiting with his gun to see if there is a wolf coming to the dead body of the lamb that we had put there. The target was the wolf. So my father said, come, I'll show you something. And I went and saw a fox. that was wandering around the dead body of the lamb. And for me, it was very fascinating to see the moonlight being reflected on the snow and the white fox. So that's what I mean when I say we were closer to nature.
And around the age of 6 or 7, your family moved from Afghanistan to Pakistan. What was the reason that that move came about?
Well, the situation in Afghanistan was getting really bad due to Taliban being in power. And the civil war had started and, you know, people were killing each other. It was unsafe for us to stay there. So we decided it's better and safer to go to Pakistan.
The history of the Taliban in Afghanistan is incredibly complex. According to Wikipedia, the Taliban is a Sunni Islamic fundamentalist political movement currently waging war within that country. They have been responsible for the brutal treatment and deaths of tens of thousands of Afghans since the mid-1990s.
So part of the reason that your family would have been, I imagine, under particular threat in a period where there was conflict within the community was because your family are Hazara.
That's right.
Can you talk a bit about who the Hazara people are and how that put you at particular risk in Afghanistan?
The Hazaras are the third largest ethnicity in Afghanistan after Pashtun and Tajik. And they are mostly Shias, Shia Muslim. Historically, they've been victim of persecution for a variety of reasons.
A quick overview here. We're looking at two issues, ethnicity and religion. The population of Afghanistan is made up of a number of ethnic groups, and Hazaras are one of them. By most accounts, the Hazaras are the third largest ethnic group in Afghanistan, after the Pashtun and the Tajik. They make up around 10% of the population. In Afghanistan, the majority of people are Sunni Muslims. The Hazaras, on the other hand, are Shia, which puts them in the minority. The Taliban refer to themselves as Sunni Muslims. However, it's really important to note that the majority of Muslims don't agree with the way that they interpret Islamic law and how they use it to justify their actions.
And in the time when you were a child in Afghanistan, what did it look like for Hazaras at that time?
So Taliban took over Afghanistan's government. And for them, the Shias were the infidel. And the Hazaras were the ones who resisted them a lot. So they brought a lot of restrictions on the Hazaras. They killed them in thousands. And there were cities where the Hazaras had resisted against them and then as a result had gotten thousands of the Hazaras killed. So for them to travel around or to live in peace was almost impossible in the era of the civil war. For them, killing the Hazaras were virtuous because they were considered to be infidel.
And Hazaras are easily identifiable as Hazara because they look different.
That's right. Hazaras have distinctive feature because of having Mongol ancestry and Turk ancestry. So we don't look like the Tajik and the Pashtun. We have Asian feature, so we are easily distinguishable.
So the day-to-day lives of Hazara people in Afghanistan at that time would have been filled with stories of people that they knew of who had been killed or were in danger and conversations about restrictions on your ability to move around the country or make decisions that you might otherwise be free to make. Is that right?
That's right.
Growing up in this environment sparked an early passion for justice in Alice's young mind. Natural justice is a concept that he's particularly passionate about, and he defines it like this.
Having an understanding that it is unfair to punish people based on the things that they have not chosen. For example, if an individual is born in a particular ethnic or a religious group or a particular group as a general, discriminating against them, punishing them or persecuting them based on what they have not chosen is unfair. So this is the demand of the natural justice to understand that using your intellectual capabilities. See, being born privileged would take away a lot of things from you. And life perspective is one of that. I was born in a minority group. I didn't choose to be born there, but I was born. So I had to deal with it. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. It was good that I was born in a minority group in Afghanistan. And we missed out on social and natural justice, you know, as a group of people. So it really mattered to us. There were times when, you know, I was listening to the elders in the family talking about how 65% of the Hazara population in Afghanistan had been massacred and they were the victim of genocide. Now, thinking of all those things, as a child, I was wondering why the heck would we have, you know, this all diversities then, you know, if people have to be punished for that. So I often had wished for a generic human face for people to have, a one language that people could speak, a one religion that people could practice, a one belief system that people could have, not to have all these, you know, discriminations and persecutions. So, you know, later on, when I grew up and became a bit more mature, I understood that this diversity is actually the beauty, that people don't see that.
In the late 1990s, Ali has fled Afghanistan with his parents and brothers. They crossed the border from Afghanistan to Pakistan with the help of people smugglers.
What changed when you moved to Pakistan? Do you remember a distinct change or difference?
Yes. Quetta was a comparatively a big town, city, and people lived closer. The houses were built, you know, closer to each other. There were not a lot of trees, not a lot of farming lands. So we rented two rooms to live in. And we had lights in Quetta, electricity and gas. And we were sent to school straight away. And I really loved to be able to go there and sit on a chair and listen to a teacher who is teaching us something. And I remember my parents encouraged us to study to have a better life.
You're an atheist. To an Australian, I think growing up in a country where we have no official religion, that's probably not much of a reason to even blink an eyelid. But in Pakistan, about 97% of people are Muslim. And in Afghanistan, it's even more than that.
That's right.
And both of those countries, Islam is the official religion of the state. What does it mean to be an atheist in Pakistan?
Well, Pakistan has a law, blasphemy law. And under that, anybody who converts or abandons Islam is considered to be apostate. And the person will be punished by death.
Have you always been an atheist?
No. I, as a child, grew up really religious. I actually practiced Islam and was quite passionate about the justice system in Islam and everything else. But then I heard some people talking about a group of people who are communist and atheist and wouldn't believe that there is a God. And that Islam is a valid religion, an absolute religion with facts. So I tried to find out about them, went and met them, and found them very civilized, educated, wonderful people.
How old were you?
Maybe 14, 15. And I was quite inspired by some of the books that I read. And I understood that, you know, religion has perhaps been a tool to exploit people in many societies by the rulers, and the superstitious beliefs within the religions, all kind of religion, has actually harmed people in a sense that has created hatred within their hearts against each other.
So did many people know about that?
Not really. Part of the reason was that I didn't want to attract attention for no reason. And I actually did have a little bit of concern about the safety too. I thought it's not wise to tell people what I actually personally believed about religion. Of course, I had friends. I had a circle of friends who I felt safe with to talk about these things. I, however, had not, you know, disclosed it publicly. So within the community, not a lot of people actually knew who I actually was. My parents didn't really know about it too. It's unacceptable, actually, to be an atheist within the Muslim family and community.
You studied a Bachelor of Arts at university in Pakistan and then worked as a tutor in a tuition centre for children in Quetta. During your classes, the concept of evolution came up, which brought some of your beliefs into the light.
I used to go to that tuition centre on a daily basis to teach students, and the chapter of evolution came up. I taught that, and I had some curious students asking me whether or not that was true. I didn't say it was or it was not. However, I encouraged them to be open-minded for any possibilities. I told that particular student who asked me this question that there are evidence and there are people who believe that it is true. The evidence, the fossils, even in today's era, the study of DNA and genes can confirm that evolution must have happened. And I explained how the whole subject of biology and then, you know, medicine and then chemistry even rely on the theory of evolution to be able to work properly.
So when that student asked that question, you're teaching within a tuition center that's operating under Muslim faith. Was it a moment where you thought, I have to make a decision here about which way I'm going to take this?
Well, as a young, new atheist, I had an urge to let people know about the truth. So I perhaps was keen to let the youngsters know. But at the same time, I did encourage them to have their own opinions and have their own research.
And what was the outcome of that?
So the next day, the same students asked another teacher if the evolution really happened. And the teacher said that it was not true and that as Muslims, they shouldn't really believe in those kind of craps. And they argued the teacher to say that, oh, but, you know, there are evidence that there are proofs that evolution happened. And the teacher said, who the heck are you getting this information from? And they said, Alias. Sir Alias has told us that this happened. And the next day I came in and the director asked me that I could not go and teach these students. He didn't tell me the reason why, but he told me that I was too busy, that I was a student as well then. So I was told to focus on my studies and, you know, because I'm too busy, another teacher is going to take the class.
So you've just given the story of what happened to you in the school, but eventually it came to the point where you had to leave Pakistan as well because you didn't feel safe there.
That's right.
Can you paint a bit of a picture of what were some of the events or what was going on in your life that led to you having to leave?
So when my parents decided to leave Afghanistan, was because of the fear of being killed. That became the case in Pakistan as well.
Terrorist attacks against Hazaras were also happening in Pakistan.
And who was doing that?
They were religious extremist groups and the people affiliated within, with Taliban.
There were claims at the time that the government was not taking action to stop the attacks because the Taliban had connections with influential people within the government. The BBC has stated that between 2001 and 2017, over 1,200 Hazaras were killed or injured in targeted attacks in the city of Quetta in Pakistan.
They were students, they were workers, government servants, teachers, doctors, politicians, people from all sects of life, the people who do trading, the shopkeepers. And I witnessed the dead bodies being buried, you know, on a very regular basis. And this has created a trauma that the whole Hazara population was going through. And they're the minority, that they can't defend themselves politically, cannot really respond politically.
So Alice was at risk for two reasons. First, as a Hazara and being outwardly perceived as a Shia Muslim. And secondly, as a closeted atheist.
Some Shia extremist groups were also emerging as a resistance against the killings. So they were being motivated by extremist ideologies as well. I heard that they had a list where they wanted to target any non-religious and non-believer within the community. And that made me really feel unsafe. So that's why I thought, no, it's unsafe. Let's just escape and go somewhere and live our life, you know, in peace and freedom and with respect and dignity. You know, life is too precious and we have to value it. We can't experiment to see whether or not we would be killed. We won't be able to escape after we are dead.
What was the most difficult thing about leaving Pakistan?
Leaving the family and friends behind and the things you love the most. The food, the culture and the memories, your identity. You know, I missed my identity. Nobody knew me in the new country. I had to rebuild it, and that was an effort to build an identity.
After 14 years, Alias left Pakistan as a young man. He managed to get hold of fake documents to travel and took a flight to Malaysia. From Malaysia, he travelled to Indonesia by boat.
When I arrived in Indonesia, you had to go and register yourself to UNHCR.
The UNHCR, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, is basically the global authority when it comes to refugees. In Indonesia, they receive and assess people's claims for refugee protection and decide whether or not someone is a genuine refugee. In Jakarta, Alias had to join the queue to register his claim with the UNHCR. He said that every day, 400 to 500 people queued. Because this queue was so big, a UNHCR officer would choose people at random.
And guess what? I was the lucky to be picked on the first day. I went for an interview and they determined that I am a genuine refugee and gave me a UNHCR card.
This card allowed Alias to wait in Indonesia until he could be resettled in another country. This is how the process of gaining refugee protection often works. You can't make a claim for protection until you've left your country. You need to cross into another country and then you can register with the UNHCR and make a claim for protection. The UNHCR will then assess your claim and decide whether or not you are a genuine refugee. Once that has been decided, you have to wait until you're offered permanent protection in another country. Refugees can spend a lifetime waiting for permanent protection. Why is that? The number of refugees globally is so much larger than the number of permanent protection visas being offered.
They wouldn't give us any time frame. So, you know, knowing people waiting there for years, some had emotional health challenges, and I could see that some were really struggling with money, with well-being. And for me to stay there longer would have been really risky. So for all those reasons, we had to decide to get the contact details of an agent to come to Australia.
I've never heard the term agent used before.
Yeah, people call them as agents. They wouldn't call them as people smuggler. That's a derogatory term introduced by perhaps Australian government, to demonize them.
What are your feelings about them? Well, it's a complex thing, isn't it?
See, I mean, a lot of people die out of surgery every year, have statistics around that. And everybody who would want to have a surgery would have a consent around the risks of that. You wouldn't really blame the doctors who had tried to do the surgery if the patient died, because they already understood the risk.
If you listen to stories of other people who have come by boat, not all share this perspective with Alias. Some have said that they were not provided full information or therefore afforded an opportunity to give informed consent about the journey ahead. But what we are hearing is Alias's experience. If you are interested in hearing a different perspective, we recommend listening to an episode of the podcast Earshot called Sink or Swim, Finding Asylum in Australia.
And do you feel like you understood the risk?
Of course. Every individual, every adult coming to Australia knew the risk. The danger, but you know, having a better life, it's worth trying for a better life despite all the risks. You know, I would say people smuggler are just like those doctors. They would tell you, see, this is the journey, you know, this is the boat. I mean, it's up to you. So everybody had decided to board those boats.
How much contact did you have with the agent before the day that you left?
We didn't really know them. We wouldn't even see them. But they had a reputation of sending successful boats to Australia. We could only rely on them through some of the people who we trusted.
But it wasn't a straightforward process for Alias. He made two attempts to come to Australia by boat. The first time, Alias and 92 other asylum seekers were on their way to board a boat when their bus was intercepted and they were arrested near Jakarta.
We were arrested by the authorities in Indonesia. 93 people were taken to a place, a detention-like place. It was almost midnight when we arrived, and we spent the night there without even having a nap because people were really scared and stressed and anxious to what might happen to them.
What were some of the fears? What were they worried about?
They were worried about being imprisoned. For 8 months, they were scared of losing their mind. They were scared of losing time. You know, they were scared that the policies might change in Australia and they might not be able to get here. and have a better life. They were scared of, you know, losing their family back home. Yes, there were many reasons to be scared. Now, I was really keen to escape. I didn't really want to be in prison or in a detention center for 8 or 9 months or a year or 2 years. My family was not very wealthy, so we couldn't really afford to pay money to get myself out.
Ali surveyed his surroundings from within the grounds to see if he could identify an escape route.
The wall on the right had mud. The wall on the left had plain field. And if you escaped from there, the guards could see you because they were upstairs having an eye on what's happening. The wall at the front had the road. That was the main entry. Now, the wall at the back had houses and properties behind it. The guards were everywhere, 3 guards on each wall. The 3 guards that was in front of the wall at the backside, for some reason they had left the wall and had come perhaps for a lunch or something. The authorities there, the policemen, had taken the UNHCR IDs of people, had photocopied them, and had brought them back to distribute. So a lot of people had just come to gather around. As soon as I saw that, I saw an opportunity. So I quickly went behind the wall, the main wall, and I was really scared. But, you know, I had to control that fear. And then I sneaked slowly and gradually, approached the main wall and climbed it. There were wires.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Really dangerous wires at the top. I climbed the wall, looked behind it. There were water running. And then I got a bit scared. I said, oh my God, I don't know how to swim. I didn't know how to swim. And the water was really muddy. And I didn't know how deep it was and how dangerous the flow were. And I climbed down. But then all the situations that I had been through flashed back. My family back home, hoping for me to get to Australia. In all the money that we had borrowed to get me to Australia. And all the other situation, the violence against the Hazaras and me as a godless person. And then I thought, you know, suddenly I got the courage back. And I said, even if it is a fire, I will have to go through it. I will go through it. It's just the water. And I climbed back the wall, jumped at the other side of the wall, hold the wires really hard so I don't drown. And then the wires had cut my hands through a little bit and I could see the scratches. Luckily, there was a dry spot just behind the wall and I hold myself just there. You know, I didn't really fall in the water. And I sneaked quickly behind the wall, went and ran. I pretended I was jogging, not to, you know, get any attention. I was wearing a t-shirt and jeans, joggers. I had joggers on. And I left my bag behind, all the clothes, all the things that I had, because I couldn't really run with that. And people would suspect me for escaping if I had that with me. So I just had my money and I didn't have any mobile phone. And then I saw a giri-giri coming, which is like a taxi, but van. Many people sit in the van. So I got like 4 or 5 giri-giris to get as far as possible from where I was. I didn't know where I was going, but I wanted to be as far from the detention as possible.
But the second time Alias attempted to board a boat to Australia, he was successful.
There was a guy, an elderly guy, who was very religious. And he himself was in the detention center for 8 or 9 months, and he really struggled there. He actually believed that I was a lucky person, that I managed to escape. The other guys were not happy to have me on the second boat. Like, they said they needed 45 people on the boat, and, you know, they have gotten all the people. But this guy who was religious said, look, if this guy, me, get on a boat, because I'm so lucky, our boat will arrive in Australia. I'm an atheist, I don't believe in luck, but I said, okay, fine. I was just quiet about it. I said, yeah, I'm lucky.
Word that there was a boat ready came at short notice. Alice and a few others were picked up in a giri-giri, which took them to a bus. They spent most of the day on board with the curtains drawn so as not to bring attention to a bus full of foreigners. It got dark, and eventually they received news that the boat was ready to be boarded.
And we finally arrived at the shore. It was raining, and we were told to be quiet. Everybody has to be absolutely very quiet because people are living around. You wouldn't want to attract any attention. We got off the bus. The only noise you could hear was the splashing of the footsteps of people on the water. And the water of the ocean felt really warm to the body. I had never been in the ocean before because Quetta, where I was, did not have any sea. And I was a bit scared too. I didn't know how to swim. And we had to get on a speedboat to be able to get to the big boat that was waiting a little bit up further in the water. So we were really scared because it was absolutely dark and, you know, we had to hold tight not to fall in the ocean. Nobody could waste time to save you then. You know, it was so dangerous. We arrived close to the big boat. We jumped on the main boat one by one. And one person tried to jump and hanged between the speedboat and the main boat and was hanging there. It was raining. It was dark. People were rushing. And he was very scared. I don't know if he knew how to swim or not. But then we managed to get him to the main boat.
They're on the boat for around 8 to 9 days. It was a small commercial fishing boat around the size of a truck. To avoid unwanted attention, the 46 passengers travelled in the hull.
The hull was stinky because the boat had been used for fishing for almost 20 years, somebody said. And it has all the stinks of the fish that had been on the boat.
Each person had a packet of noodles and a hard-boiled egg to eat each day. There was no tool in the boat, so the group agreed on a dedicated spot on the side of the boat where they could go directly into the ocean.
We were traveling, the sea was calm, and then it slowly got really bad one particular night. It was raining, the boat was shaking, the waves were hitting the boat. People were screaming and praying, and they were really scared. The rain was pouring like a shower, as if somebody is throwing water with big buckets on you. That's how bad it was. And we were trying to protect the hull not to be full of water, because if the hull got full of water, the boat would have drowned. So we were some people trying to protect with the plastic sheet to stop the water to get in the hull.
So you said that other people seemed terrified and were screaming and praying. How were you feeling in that moment?
I was just observing everybody. I know I was not really scared. You know, I think miseries love company, and I had company in that misery. And I didn't feel victimized as if I'm the only person. So, you know, I tried to help in the situation in whatever ways I could. Being scared would only make things worse, I think.
Gradually the storm subsided, and the next morning it was over.
It was funny, the next day, the water was so smooth, as if the ocean water has been ironed. And we could see the fish because the water was so clean and the water was so transparent. And we also had witnessed the flying fish, and everybody was so happy to see that. And we also were accompanied by dolphins. There were dolphins, you know, jumping around us, and it was amazing to see those wonderful sea life as well.
Eventually, the boat was intercepted by the Australian Navy at Ashmore Reef. Ashmore Reef lies approximately halfway between Broome in Western Australia and Timor, and is in Australian territory. They were taken to Christmas Island, where Alias spent about 45 days in immigration detention. After this, he was transferred to another detention centre in Port Augusta, 300 kilometres north of Adelaide, where he spent 3 months. During his time in detention, Alias's claim for refugee protection was assessed by the Australian government and approved. He was released in Adelaide in June 2010 as a recognised refugee with a permanent protection visa.
In my country, Australia, where I live now, refugees and people seeking asylum are used for political gains or political agendas. They are considered political issues.
That must have been a huge day for you. Do you remember that day clearly?
Yeah, absolutely. We were actually three people who got the visas from that detention center. We traveled along the hills and valleys from Port Augusta to get to Adelaide in a car for almost 3 hours. It was a fantastic feeling. It was June. It was getting cold. It was for the first time that I could really experience Australia. And I was so happy.
Again, Alias's luck worked in his favour. Had he arrived after the 13th of August 2012, he would have not been allowed to settle in Australia. He would have likely been transferred to Nauru or Manus Island under the government's Operation Sovereign Borders.
We knew the people who suffered from Nauru and Manus Island during the Howard period. And I was, you know, we were scared that we would be taken to an offshore detention centre. And we might be punished for coming to Australia.
Alias was immediately impressed by the diversity of people he saw in the community. But despite that, it took him a while to feel comfortable. A few days after his release from detention, he was on a train for the first time with a few friends.
I was dressed well and I was a bit paranoid because we were given so much attention in the detention center as if we were aliens and, you know, everybody in Australia was concerned because of us. So I was a bit paranoid. I said, well, if they have spent so much money to detain us for 3 months and have spent so much money to have all these people, officers from the Department of Immigration, from the Serco, the nurses from IHMS, you know, the interpreters and translators, we must be really people that would, you know, bother these old people on the ground as well. I was paranoid that people might be gazing and saying, you know, these cursed people are here. But then slowly and gradually, you know, I tried to really test my belief whether or not that was true. I slowly tried to look at people and find out whether or not they were actually gazing at me. They were not. Everybody was busy and doing their own businesses. And then I realized, you know, we are not so much of a problem for the common Australians, but, you know, to be played politics with.
His first jobs in Australia were brief. He worked on an olive farm in Swan Hill, pruning trees, and then in a chicken factory in Mildura.
It was a fast-paced work, you know, a very busy place with a different culture. People running around all the time. Couldn't really catch up. I was still dealing with the new change. So I was just letting and leaving those feelings. But I didn't quit. I kept going despite being slow, despite not being so well at the job. I didn't quit. And I was fired at the end because they thought I couldn't do the job. And I was happy that I at least didn't quit.
He found casual work as an interpreter with Centrelink. And then in 2012, he heard about a job opportunity in Brisbane with a refugee settlement organisation. He applied and was offered an interview. But when they realised he was in Mildura, the offer was withdrawn.
The job was not for people who lived out of Brisbane because the job did involve area orientation and, you know, an understanding of the area.
But then you applied again.
Yes, so because the guy told me that it was for somebody who knew Brisbane better, I decided to to change my address on my resume. And I put my friend's address because I did have an intention to move to Brisbane and live with a friend if I got the job. And then a few weeks later, I again received a call and was asked whether or not I was interested. And he said, after tomorrow, there is an interview at 10 o'clock. Could you come? And I said, of course, I can. So I took the bus or a train to come to Melbourne. And then from Melbourne, I took a flight to come to Brisbane. So I just made it on time for the interview. And my interview went well. I got the job.
You were working with people who were going through the same experiences that you'd been through. What was it like for you supporting people that had shared experience?
Well, it was a very good feeling. One of the things I really enjoyed about the job was that people who arrived here had dreams and hopes for the future. And I could see them really fresh in their eyes and in their attitude. And that always inspired me. I love to teach them how to do things better. And, you know, the things that I missed out on, I shared those experiences with them. Like, for example, you know, running behind an employment, that is not for you. You know, it would just waste your time and energy and effort. You know, instead, focus on something that you would like to do. And it might take time, but you will get there. And wanted to let them know that these challenges would be overcome.
I'm really interested in this idea of from struggle comes strength.
Yeah.
It's interesting to hear you say, you know, you're lucky. What is it that you gain from being part of a minority group and seeing yourself as different?
I think living through that experience would give you an insight of the impact of the things that people do unconsciously. For example, a particular group of people, a privileged particular group of people, would make it really casual and okay for a certain group of minorities to be marginalized, stigmatized, to look down upon, to make fun of. So being from that particular minority group, you would understand the impact, the deep impact that it would have over your life. So that perspective and insight would help you to make sure that it doesn't really happen, so others don't suffer from it.
In 2012, Alias met his wife, Wajiha. They married in 2013 and had their son, Abir, in 2015.
Wajiha's a Muslim woman. I'm really interested in you as someone who strongly doesn't believe in God and has, you know, such deep roots in what religion has meant to you in your life. But you're married to a woman who has really different beliefs. How do you negotiate that really deep difference?
Well, that's very interesting because after meeting Wajiha, I stopped labeling people as Muslims, Christians, you know, white, black, whatever, you know. So I guess labeling people would actually stop their internal light to come out because the label that you put on people and all those labels would block the real light that actually is coming out of an individual. So I saw Wajiha as who she was, very strong woman with strong character, with wonderful determination, and a person who could trust others. And that's a character strength, to trust.
What's your approach together in how you raise your son in regards to religion?
Well, I guess he has the right to have neutral approach, not to be indoctrinated towards any beliefs, whatever belief system. I would not be happy if a school or an institution or us as parents influence him forcefully to adopt a particular belief system. I would want him to grow up as free boy and choose whatever he wants to choose. And at the same time, I would not block him not to know about things. I would want him to have neutral approach towards every religion, every belief system, every philosophy. They choose for himself what he wants to be.
Has being married and being a father changed you in any way?
Yes, a lot. Actually, the family has given me the stability that I had long struggled for. So the family has given me that well-being that I can fight with any challenges. In my country, the ideal country that I would like to live in, people coming and asking for help, refugees and people seeking asylum, they would not be considered to be an issue. Rather, the army that is sent overseas to cause wars would be a matter of concern in political arena and in public debates.
At the start of this interview, you know, I asked you what was the most difficult thing about leaving Pakistan, and one of the things that you said was that you had an identity there and you had to leave that behind and find a new identity here.
Yeah, that's right.
Who are you now?
I think the challenge is that my identity is being imposed by the people who are expert on character assassination, are by the media and authority, who would box us as refugees, as Muslims, as communists, as, you know, as whatever. And that's a struggle. People don't see me as me. People see me as an individual from a group of person. I often meet people who are either extra sympathetic, too passionate about refugees, or I meet people who don't like refugees, you know. So you miss out on a neutral approach. You want to know who you actually are as individual. And with interaction with people, you create an identity. Your name, PR, my name, alias, wouldn't really matter if I lived alone in a jungle or on a mountain somewhere. So our identity comes from interaction with people. And the society that we live in has got really strong, fixed opinion about the newcomers here. And that should not really be the case.
We've spoken before about what you see as the dominant narrative around asylum seekers and refugees in Australia, in the media, in public conversation. What's the dominant narrative in your eyes?
Well, it was Hitler's propaganda minister who said to others, you know, small lies are of no use. Tell a big fat lie and then repeat it over and over and over and over again until it looks true. So the dominant narrative around people seeking asylum in Australia is of the people who've lied about us and have repeated over and over again that the common, wonderful, beautiful Australians on the ground have believed.
And what are the lies that you've seen?
The lies are that we are illegal migrants, are illegal refugees. That's not true. Under the convention that Australia is signatory of, anybody can come to Australia by any means to ask for protection and safety. So calling them, labeling them as illegal is actually wrong. Introducing mandatory detention is another internal law that is, you know, unfair. That actually has, you know, victimized people and have made it okay for others to be all right with incarceration and imprisonment of people coming here who have, you know, escaped wars and persecutions. See, it's hard to be neutral, and I often struggle with that as well, to have neutral approach. But sometimes I am aware of my biases, and a good friend of mine had been telling me this, that, you know, being aware of your biases would help you have a neutral approach.
What are your biases?
Unconscious biases are there. I wouldn't have it intentionally. For example, I'm paranoid from the politicians, you know, the ethnic groups. As a child, I struggled with that. I doubt almost every person in authority. I'm biased towards them. I would think that people with power and authority are somehow corrupt and I wouldn't trust them. So these are my biases and I'm aware of that and I have to really deal with it rationally. So people listening me should really take out all the biases and look through the message. And it's hard to look through, but they should try.
And what's the story that you think we should be telling? How do you think that we could be talking about people who've come here seeking asylum?
See, I mean, I would say people who have never met a refugee should really not be concerned about it. People don't meet me. I mean, I have my neighbors who wouldn't really bother to come and talk to us and know us. We do talk, we do say hi, but, you know, there is this invisible barrier for whatever reasons. We don't really get to know each other as humans and as people. People who have met refugees would know who they are. People who have friends, refugee friends, they actually know who they are. So my advice would be to all the people concerned about the refugees and people seeking asylum, if you really care about them, just meet one and talk to them. You know, instead of believing the narrative that is being sold by the politicians, me being different should actually be a cause for people to be more curious to come and find out about me. Australians might not do that to each other, but I guess, you know, my neighbor should be curious to know where we are from and how we've come to Australia and what are some of the challenges.
I've heard you talk before about the idea of seeking refuge as an act of peace.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Can you tell me about that?
So, yeah, his name is Shah Servari. He's a Hazara artist. And he tried to tell others that refugees actually are the contributors of peace. Because in a war-torn country, if you stay for your safety, you might either kill or be killed. It's one or the other way. So all the refugees escaping the war-torn countries actually should be thanked for to contribute towards the peace internationally, because they have chosen to stay non-violent. They've chosen to walk away. They've chosen not to take arms and kill or be killed.
Alias, thank you so much. Cheers.
All right. Thank you. Cheers.
We think these are important conversations to be having, and we'd love you to join in. Find us on Facebook or Instagram at In My Country Podcast.
If you like what you've heard, please tell your friends and rate us on your podcasting app or wherever you're listening. It helps us to be heard by more people.
This podcast was produced and edited by Adam Wood and Pia Perversi-Birchall.
Sound is mixed by David Gaylard. All of our music is from Free Music Archive. You can find full credits in the show notes or at inmycountrypodcast.com. Thanks for listening.
This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.